Welcome all to this live session at Latticework 2021. It is a great pleasure for me to welcome to this session Scott Miller, founder of Green Haven Road Capital, and Savneet Singh, president and CEO of PAR Technology. I will introduce Scott briefly, and then I'll ask Scott to introduce Savneet properly here. Scott is somebody that I admire and have had the opportunity to get to know over the years. Scott has attended the Zurich Project. What really strikes me about Scott is that he really is a model of how to succeed in business and investing, in my book. The firm he's founded and the letters I read periodically, Scott, I think really show why a lot of emerging managers as well as capital allocators gravitate toward you, because you really, in my mind, make sure that everyone gets value from interactions with you. Just briefly on Green Haven Road Capital, it's a boutique investment partnership that seeks off the beaten path investments modeled after the early Buffett partnerships. It's built on a belief that a focused investment manager can outperform an index by limiting fund capacity and concentrating exposure on a few great ideas over the long-term time horizon. Scott has experience as an owner-operator himself. He had co-founded Accelero Learning and grew that company before switching, I guess, to focusing on investing. He has an MBA and master's in education from Stanford University. And I think today's guest kind of is a great case study and example of Scott's investment approach. And so at this point, Scott, I will turn it over to you to set the stage for us and take it away with this fireside chat.
Thanks, John. You can introduce me anytime you want based on that one. Wow. But before I get to 70 and everything, I know we opened this up to folks on a broader audience, people that aren't necessarily members. I just want to sort of say, I'm a paying customer of Manual of Ideas, right? I paid to attend this event. I've been a paying customer for a number of years. I think you do a really great job of, thoughtful investors are sprinkled around the world and they're sort of hard to connect with. And you do a great job of convening people and teasing out thoughts and ideas. And so if you've never been a member to try Manual of Ideas, I think there's a wait list, but I'd say now's a good time to get on the wait list if you haven't, if you're kind of thoughtful about investing and want to get better at it. So that's just my sort of disclaimer. I'm a paying customer. It's not like I'm paid in any way. So getting to the session, with Savneet Singh, so full disclosure, Green Haven Road is a shareholder in PAR Technology. I think we have some frameworks I talk about in my letters about making jockey bets and sort of having this notion of a fight club, and we're investing in people managing assets versus assets managed by people. And one of the, I think, sort of more flexible thinkers and out there, and one of the jockeys we have bet on is Savneet Singh. And so I think, Savneet, one place to start that might be helpful is, the way John alluded to, I have more of an operating background than many fund managers. I think you have more of an investing background than many CEOs. Do you want to just kind of set the context here for folks, give maybe a little bit of your background and maybe hitting some of the kind of finance related pieces in ways that you might not otherwise, because I think it gets into sort of this investing conversation we're going to have.
Yeah, so I started out my career in a very traditional finance path. I spent 2 years doing investment banking at Morgan Stanley. And then I worked at a large hedge fund because I had this dream of, wanting to learn to invest like Warren Buffett. And I tried working at a hedge fund for a year. No disrespect to Scott and all the amazing hedge fund managers here, but I realized that wasn't the place to learn to be Warren Buffett. And I had always had a strong entrepreneurial bug and, left and started a company in the financial technology space. It was an incredible experience. I did it for seven and a half years. And, you know, I think learned, you know, how hard it is to be an operator, but also how rewarding it is to get it right and to win. And, you know, after that experience, I left and went on this journey of trying to build a set of investment businesses. And the one probably most relevant here is I had, you know, really early on, I think, observed the power of great software businesses. I had seen that, you know, once you build a great product, integrate into large organizations, you're building businesses with gigantic moats. You know, my favorite line has always been, you know, if Warren Buffett was 30, this is all he'd be looking at. And I said, hey, you know, if you were going to envision the next Berkshire Hathaway, you'd probably think about building it around great enterprise software businesses. And so let's go try to find that. Except our angle was to sort of find growth assets. And this comes back to your to the foundation of your question, which is we were operators in nature. So we didn't want to sort of just be passive allocators, but we wanted to actually have some operating influence. And so we went on this journey, and it's a very long story, but, you know, we stumbled on PAR. You know, originally we tried to carve out an asset out of PAR. The company was interested. And, you know, later I stumbled my way onto the board. And then 8 months later, after, you know, I'd say, you know, not a good situation, but a relatively traumatic situation, I ended up becoming the CEO. So, you know, it's one of those things that you couldn't have predicted. It wasn't really meant to be that way. But, you know, it turned out that PAR was the asset that we wanted to sort of build into our little mini Berkshire Hathaway, but very focused on serving, you know, one end constituent, which is restaurants.
That's a good background. Can you give just for folks to what does PAR do a little bit? A little bit of background there. Some people, you know, literally have never heard you speak. Other people are, you know, I'd say PAR fanboys. So somewhere in between.
Sure. So PAR, I love saying the founding story of PAR, and I speak fast, so I'm going to squeeze it in again. But, you know, the company was founded, you know, 54 years ago now as a defense contractor selling IT services to the DoD. You know, think of it as data scientists before they were called data scientists. In 1978, the founders of PAR invented the point of sale terminal because one of their mothers was a McDonald's franchisee. 2 years, literally 2 years after inventing it, McDonald's adopted it as an approved system to be sold within McDonald's. But maybe more interesting, in 1982, McDonald's mandated that if you were running McDonald's, you had to run on a PAR system. And on that news, PAR went public. It sort of took off the next 5-6 years as, you know, restaurants moved from cash registers to point of sale systems. But unfortunately, the subsequent 25, 30 years, the company really went the wrong way. And it was primarily because it missed out on building and shipping software. And so as customers started realizing that it wasn't the device in the store that mattered, but the software inside that helps you run your operations, they would buy the software from third parties and then bundle it onto PAR hardware. And so PAR got stuck as this cyclical hardware and services company, while Oracle or you know, Micros and Aloha and these amazing software products grew really quickly and built the higher quality model. So, you know, to rectify that, you know, 25, 30 years later, PAR bought a small SaaS product called Brink. And the way to think about this is that Toast and Square and these amazing businesses were built to sell, to re-envision how you ran your small restaurant. All of us have been to a coffee shop and have that Square experience. You see how easy it is to the consumer side. But what you don't see is how amazing it is on the operator side. It is a, you know, it's a wow experience if you're working at that restaurant and you upgrade to a modern software product. And what Brink was, that version for the enterprise restaurant, which is incredibly complicated, much, much harder. And so the thesis PAR had when bought the business was, hey, that same, you know, innovation, that same sort of technology revolution that's happening in small coffee shops and in small restaurants is going to happen in the enterprise. And so that was the rocket ship that PAR sort of attached its future to. And so today, you know, we've grown a lot since that time. Today, we've sort of morphed from a company that just sold point of sale systems to, you know, I think being the fastest growing and certainly the largest pure cloud operator in the enterprise space of restaurants. And we've bolted on a back office product, loyalty product, which we can talk about as well. And so the way we'd like to think about PAR is we're giving you a platform to run your enterprise restaurant. So we are absolutely the wrong solution if you're a single store restaurant. We are not queried for. But if you're Arby's, if you're Five Guys, we are the platform we want you to run your restaurant on.
And can you sort of parse that out just a little bit for folks? Like, you know, you're in restaurant technology, just like Toast, but, and you're making that distinction between SMB and enterprise, but like, what are some of the like actual nuanced differences there?
So the way I think about the distinction between SMB and enterprise is if you ran a single store restaurant, your needs are literally defined by the four walls of your restaurant. You know, if you've got one store, you really don't need a great loyalty app, right? Your people are coming in because they come for that one store. You really don't need modern labor software. You certainly don't need, you know, a robust online ordering system. You can literally use anything off the shelf. You don't have a massive supplier network. You don't have a massive supplier software. You don't have franchisees. You don't have reporting systems. You're not using Snowflake. You're not using mParticle. You're literally, you know, running your single store operator. And now compare that to running Arby's and thinking about all the stuff that runs through an Arby's. And the way that I sort of mentally frame it is, you've got everything I just described that happens in the store, but then you've got franchisees, you've got cybersecurity rules, you've got 20 different reporting softwares that end up rolling up to the owner of that concept. And so it's an incredibly challenged way to look at the system. And so the way that we think of Brink, our core product, is that you have the in-store operations, which is, hey, here's a great product to run your in-store. And that's actually relatively similar to what a Toast or a Square would do. You've got to process transactions, you've got to push that data out to all sorts of systems. But then you have the above store functionality, which is everything that, you know, you need for franchisees, for suppliers, for everything that it comes outside the store. And then we have a third module, which is called integrations, which is all the entry points to an enterprise restaurant that you wouldn't have in a small business. And so that can be everything from your drive-through, but to something more complex like the robotic delivery services some of our chains are testing out. And so the work to service an enterprise is just, you know, 5-10 times more than it is to make to service a small restaurant.
I think it's sort of implied in all this, getting ripped out is, churn is lower, right? For you guys, it should be because—
Of course. And you know, part of the, you know, people always ask, you know, restaurants are crappy businesses, right? You'd sort of this modicum that we've like lift off of. And I always say they are, but franchise and restaurants are amazing businesses. You know, these QSR chains are truly incredible businesses. They're capital light, the returns on capital are super high. And so part of the reason that we chose this vertical to be in and to run at PAR was we knew the end market was actually really strong. And I think that was a little bit misunderstood. And so the churn in enterprise businesses is in this enterprise market is extremely low. You know, at PAR, our churn is, you know, low single digits every year because the business is staying business. And it is really, really hard to rip it out. And this is going to sound terrible, Scott, but, you know, when I was sort of looking at software stocks back in the day, I would say, you know, I'd rather buy a basket of the lowest NPS stocks and the high NPS stocks. Because if you're around and you're growing as a low NPS product, like that just means you're stuck. And the opportunity is so high. And PAR was a little bit like that.
That's fascinating. And so just parsing out, I think it really matters, like kind of the nuanced differences, right? So enterprise versus SMB has these implications for churn, has implications for different sort of products you can integrate with, but also like the competitive landscape, right? So as investors, most of us, you know, we see and interact with Toast. That hasn't historically been the primary competitors. Like what are your primary competitors?
Yeah, so let me just add one thing to what you said, which is there are product differences, which we just described, which is, you know, you're serving so many more constituents when you're an enterprise product. There's also business model differences and how we go to market is dramatically different. Our sales cycles are a year, year and a half. You know, when you're selling down market, you can sell somebody on an Instagram ad and they'll, you know, you ship them the software, you know, ship them point of sale terminal and they're up and running. The go-to-market is different. The pricing is different. And so I look at them as almost completely different end markets as you sort of evolve down the road. And so the way that I think about the enterprise market is our first sale to the enterprise customer is relatively small. We're selling them point of sale software. And that product is $2,000, $2,100, sometimes $2,500, sometimes $2,000 a year. And that's all we charge. And then from there, over time, we'll upsell them loyalty. Eventually, we'll upsell them online ordering. And we'll upsell them and we'll sort of move up that stack of more and more sticky, sticky, sticky products. Versus down market, where literally on that first sale, you're bundling point of sale, you're probably bundling online ordering, bundling payments, you might bundle labor, and you get this big sale up front. And so early on, the CAC to LTV down market looks incredible, which is why venture capital, you know, ran to that market, which is like, wow, you can bundle $10,000 a year of software to a small restaurant. You can only do $2,000 to that enterprise restaurant up market. Over time though, I think the enterprise market becomes because it's so sticky, actually has longer term LTVs. And so that's the bet that we're kind of making, which is yes, the CAC to LTV of course down market is great because you can sell so much more upfront, but over time, I think you'll end up better. A, as you mentioned, the churn is lower, but the number of products needed in an enterprise restaurant will grow and grow and grow. And I would tell you in the last 5 years, there have been more restaurant technology companies created than there were in the history of restaurant time. And in the next 5 years, it's going to happen all over again. And most of that will go to these enterprise restaurants.
Makes total sense. And in terms of your competitors, right?
Yeah, one of the great things about PAR is that who we compete with. So our biggest competitors without question are NCR, which has a product called Aloha, and Oracle, which has a product called Micros. There's other companies, Xenial, there's you know, tons of legacy companies, many of them bought by payment companies. And these are really solid, stable products. They're not bad products. These aren't sort of products that you're like taking down your store, but they're older products. They're not modern, and they're all owned by organizations where they are a minority of the business. And the reason why that's important is that because they aren't the primary focus of those businesses can't turn on a dime and say, you know what, we've got these great businesses, they generate lots of cash, we're going to reinvent the product now. Because you're not the focus. I imagine at PAR, if we had a 5% revenue line that was generating 35% cash flow margins, and all of a sudden that manager came to me and said, hey, can I take that down to zero because I want to reinvent the product? Like, I'm just going to be like, that's too much brain damage. It's too much distraction, like, for a 5% product line. And so as a result, these companies are, you know, we like to think a little bit fat, a little bit happy, you know, great margins. And they're the perfect pool for us to fish in because we're not competing against Silicon Valley, you know, 2.0. This is Silicon Valley 1.0. You know, I have immense admiration for Square, for Toast. I think these are world-class companies, but we're not really competing against them. I mean, today we're really competing against these older legacy type companies, and you see it every day in the market. You look at the sales folks and you're just like, you know, I feel like I'm going back 10 years. You look at the pace of product development. It's nowhere close to what a Toast or a Square is doing. And so we look at those as our core competitors. But if you ask me, you know, we sort of are believers that, you know, we've always been looking over our shoulder. The competitors over time will eventually become Toast. It'll become Square. It'll become everybody. But today we have this beautiful like competitive moat, and that we're not really competing against the best developers in the world.
And just for like audience members, I think Oracle has mentioned Micros in a public setting one time in the last 7 years to give you a sense of kind of how important Micros might be within the overall Oracle landscape, right? So
you'll find it on their website, right? It's not like, you know, if you're a customer and you're excited, you're sort of like, you know, try to find it on the website. It takes some time.
Yeah. So, all right. I think another place I wanted to go was around talking a little bit about team. I sort of teed you up as kind of Fight Club and a jockey, but in terms of like winning, the importance of team, and like, can you talk a little bit about what you've been doing and some of the changes you're trying to make on the team level?
Yeah, and I sort of skipped this a little bit in the PAR review, but you know, I think when we stepped into PAR now, you know, 3 years ago, it was a very challenged business. And to me, every business problem is just a people problem. You know, in the end, businesses are just organizations of people that have decided to do something. And we really, really early on got obsessed about building a great team at PAR. And so, you know, the first way we did is we came out with a very set of simple values. You know, we value speed, people who run up the escalator, people who run up, don't wait for the elevator, people who run upstairs, they're ready to go. We look for owners, not renters. So people that we can say, hey, go do this, and they own it through and through. We look for people that love to focus, and we look for people who are absolutely about winning. And the reason we made this so intense is we wanted that intense, rigorous culture because we were in a really challenged situation. And so we've obsessed over building a talent factory and a talent engine at PAR. And sort of the way that I like to give you sort of an anecdote about it is, you know, today, our CTO, Raju, his prior job to working at PAR and Punch was the CPTO of Salesforce Marketing Cloud, you know, which is one of the largest marketing software businesses in the world. And now he's running an engineering product at PAR. The guy before him, who's a great guy, awesome person, he was managing 13 people, and then he became the CTO of PAR. And so you just think of that step function of talent that we just changed, which is, you know, the prior guy was literally working with 13 people, and this guy was running Salesforce Marketing Cloud. You can't imagine what that does to an organization from the quality of what we're building. And you'll see that throughout all of PAR, which is you sort of started here and now we're here. And in many ways, I'd say for the first 2 years of the business, the talent was better than the business. We were attracting people who came from, you know, 3G Capital, Google, Blackstone. And today we're sort of the business is catching up to that. And that's kind of always how it works. And so we really, really worked hard to kind of build that. And it's not easy. It's not a bunch of fun. It's a lot of hard work, but that's kind of what we obsess over. And, you know, my favorite metric is this has been the year of the great resignation, and it's certainly hit PAR in every other company, but you know, we've barely lost. I can't think of a senior person. We haven't lost one senior person. And I take a lot of pride in that. That wasn't because it was a fun and fluffy year. It was because I think people felt really proud of what we've accomplished and how we've got here. And they feel great about building something for the long run. So, you know, the results will tell, but in general, we think if there's a problem, it's generally a people problem. And then we try to find the best talent we can and bring them on board.
And so that's helpful. I want to just talk a little bit about qualitative things that don't necessarily show up in numbers, right? So like the competitive landscape doesn't show up in numbers, but like I think in your case, you sort of benefit from going up against some legacy providers. I think one of the things that because if you're a software investor, right, like we're trained to look at things like billings and growth and but I think you guys have a, like what I would call a shadow backlog that you talk about sometimes. Can you? But I think like as an investor, it's like it's a real asset. And can you talk a little bit about what that is?
So when we sign a large customer, you know, Dairy Queen is one of our largest customers. Dairy Queen has around 4,500 or 5,000 stores. Dairy Queen, the institution, is very committed to sort of having PAR run in every single store. And it's very simple. If they have the same IT stack in every store, their ability to move quickly as an organization increases dramatically. So if they decide to update their website, their loyalty system, their back office systems, they're plugging into one system. Versus today, if you've got 25 different systems, it's a ton of work to redo every integration every time you make a change or make an upgrade. You change a vendor, you're doing 25 integrations versus one. And so the corporates are incredibly incentivized to have one platform to run their own organization. And so when we signed a Dairy Queen as an example, they are committing nothing more than saying we want to roll PAR out. We then have to go convince all these franchisees to kind of sign up for PAR. And so what the beauty of our business is at some point we know everybody will come over, almost everybody, because they have no choice. But it takes some time to roll them out. And so at the end of Q3, we were installed around 15,000 stores. But if you look of those of our large logos, we're barely half penetrated through the vast majority of our large logos. And so the way to think about it is if Dairy Queen is 5,000 stores and we're in 2,500 of them, there's another 2,500 of shadow backlog that are going to come over time. And so that shadow backlog, you know, is probably another 10,000 stores that we haven't even, booked yet. And so the beauty of that is our sale, we could get rid of our direct sales team and still keep growing the business for the next 2 years very comfortably without signing new logos. Now, we'd never do that, but it builds this awesome momentum in the background, which is I can create growth by the lever of signing new logos, but I also can create growth by making a massive penetration into our, Arby's and Dairy Queen and so on and so forth by signing up existing customers. There is a really, really lucky part of this, which is the corporates that we work with are now seeing the value of this technology. They're realizing that, hey, during the pandemic, if only half my stores had access to the new loyalty product, like those stores did a lot better. And so I really, really want more stores to get that. And i.e., I'm going to put incentives. And so we have literally organizations today that are saying, hey, if you switch on to PAR by the end of 2022, we're going to cut your royalty points for that year. That's massive savings. And so we're benefiting from our customers seeing the value of our products. And that shadow backlog sort of, I think provides great foundation for growth in the next few years.
That's thank you for explaining that for folks. So I think that's a really positive, like sort of hidden asset, right? In terms of, it's not so clear from just if you do a quantitative screen that it's there. Like on the negative side, I think you inherited a fair amount of technical debt, and that had some implications for you on sort of growth and other things. Can you talk a little bit about kind of what investors might not have seen, but was going on the inside when you got to PAR and sort of where you are now, maybe? I don't think that was clear to folks. There were some activists involved, and
it wasn't clear to me either. So I think when you sort of looked at PAR at the outside from, at the end of 2018 when we stepped in, you look like it was this sort of legacy hardware company that has very fast growing software asset. And you assumed that software asset was just like any other software business. It's got great growth, so there's great retention. It's a clean shop. I think when I got to the job, the thing that scared me the most was, wow, the NPS on this thing is like, negative 50 or 60. I mean, it was really, really bad. The sad thing was at the time, it was the same as the employee NPS, which is also negative 50 or negative 60, right? And so it doesn't make sense though. The business has been growing like 50 to 100% a year, and the employee NPS was horrendous and the customer NPS was horrendous. It kind of was like, what's going on here? And what I observed, and I think we saw, was that while the product was growing very quickly, it was growing in the wrong way. It was a cloud product that had 37 different versions running. So, it was a cloud, but it wasn't really a cloud product, because instead of actually building the product and having your changes built into releases, you were just copying and pasting and building a new version for a customer's needs. And so you were losing all the benefits of being a cloud product. And that wasn't done because the prior team was sort of dumb. It was because there was a lack of capital, lack of people, and it's a lot faster to just say, I don't take the risk of like putting that into the next release. I'm just going to make a new version and do it for that customer and put them on their own stack. And so we built up an incredible amount of technical debt, an incredible amount. And you can't scale at that pace and actually ever think that you could solve that problem. And so what we did is we made the very strategic decision to go to our investors very early on and say, you know what, we need to bring this growth down considerably. And we're going to take all of our resources, literally all of our resources, and put it towards hardening our product and scaling our product and not on new product development. And we're going to figure out new product development through M&A is effectively what we decided. And so that was a 2-year journey of getting it to the point. And there's a great example here, which is one of our largest customers, who I mentioned, would have me fly to their offices once a month just to scream at me for 30 minutes, and then I would fly right back. And I did that for 6 months, boom, back and forth, back and forth. And you know, it was incredibly, it was terrible. But on that first meeting, I came to the office. I said, hey, I'm the new guy. We're going to try to fix this thing. And you know, he comes out and he prints me a piece of paper and says, hey, here's all the stuff that was promised to me when I signed this deal in 2016 or 2017. And I looked at it and I said, I'm going to be honest with you. Like, we're not going to get to any of this in the next 2 years. So let's do this. Why don't we stop billing you today and create a plan for you to go back to Oracle, and you'll have a great experience with your old vendor, and we'll focus on making ourselves better. And I'm going to go win your business in 2 years from now. And the guy was like, whoa. You're still so much better than what we had before. Like, I want to work with you. And so in my mind, I was like, okay, like there's something to build here, but it's going to, and I have to explain to my customers that we need that time to make the product great. And so during, in that same customer who would scream at me literally every 6 months, six times to the same office and back, is now mandating that every store get on par by the end of 2022. And to sort of, it's just such an amazing change that to see that our customers now believe in our product. Our product is rock solid. It doesn't go down. And so I went from, you know, every board meeting being like, how many times did Brink go down? What's, you know, how bad is NPS? Who's leaving? To now it's like, why aren't we building this? And so it's an amazing transition for us to understand that 2 years of my life, we had investors clamoring for growth and so on and so forth. And I was like, I just want to keep the thing from breaking. And so, you know, we're never going to be done with that. It's always technical debt. You always have to address it. You have to attack it. You have to have a plan. But, you know, we've gotten the product where it works, and we can actually think a little bit more about where we want to be as opposed to just surviving. And that was a very fine balance, because I think as investors, you just don't get that motion, right? It's just sort of like, wait, is the product bad? Is it not working? And, you know, having lived in enterprise software, you know, I sort of know that no product is perfect. Like, there's no product that's not technical debt. It's just a mountain to climb, but you can only do it if you go all in on it. You know, if you kind of do it in the background, like it's never going to happen. And so we made that really hard decision, and it cost us a lot. You know, it gave competitors an opportunity. We lost talent because, you know, Scott, if you're a great engineer, do you want to come to the company that's like, hey, this is this amazing opportunity. Restaurants are becoming software companies, but all your work is going to be like fixing this product that was, you know, and so that's when I say that our culture really hardened too, because it was about, you know, like fixing this challenge. And so, it's the thing I'm most proud about, that literally our two largest customers, our two most angry customers, mandated it. And that's huge, because that doesn't happen in restaurants. And, you know, our investors that financed our large acquisition, you know, like went from hating us to financing us. And so we've seen this transition of the product actually starting to work.
That's thanks for telling that story. You did make a decision to build payments. And so, like, you're talking about, like, sort of addressing technical debt, your general strategy is on acquisitions. I'm just kind of curious if you could tease out your thought process a little bit for folks on kind of what buy, build versus partner, and in particular, kind of why build payments?
So, you know, payments is a really commoditized business. You know, I think that one of the things that, you know, one of my advice for those investing in software is, you know, don't get so excited about these businesses that leverage payments so much, because this is truly a commodity product. And, you know, I sort of get excited about this idea of, like, you know, if payments race the bottom, like then you should be the one to race it there and come up with a product to do it. And so, you know, how do you say, hey, I'll give you payments for this, but I'm going to have sell you a software product on top of it that will do X, Y, and Z. And so at PAR, we said, if that's our vision, which is, hey, this is a commoditized business. Like, Scott, if you chose PAR or Toast or Square or WorldPay or First Data, there's literally no difference in your payment experience as the operator, right? It's integrated into your point of sale system. And that's where you see the observable changes, and it's integrated into your financial statements, but there's nothing there. And so my vision of payments was like, gosh, like if that's it, then you've got to actually build a product on top of that payments business for it to actually be a great money generator. And if the only way we can do it is if we actually built it ourselves, because if I'm just taking a bunch of pieces from third parties and then saying, hey, this is PAR payments, I can't really reinvent that on top. And so we took that decision. I also say it was incredibly financially driven too. If you're the payment facilitator and you're taking on the risk of that transaction, your margins are much higher. And the beauty of, again, selling to fast casual and quick service restaurants is that they're really low risk from a fraud perspective. Nobody steals a credit card to buy a burger. And so, you know, it was part financial, But for us, it's sort of, it was like one of those things, which is, I think if we can build it out ourselves, we'll have the ability to create new product on top of it. But if we collected a bunch of third-party stuff, you know, we never will be the ones to be innovative in that market. Now, that's not the case for everything that we do, but in here, we actually wanted to sort of be innovators here and not just copy what everybody else was doing.
Got it. All right, cool. Let's if we could just shift gears a little bit and like put on your investor hat. If I'm just curious, like if you had to move over to the fund side, like, okay, PAR is taken away from you for whatever reason, you said, okay, you got to go start a fund. How would you approach investing?
So, you know, I think being an operator, I think has made me a better investor. You know, part of that is you have no time to look at stuff. And so you buy stuff you know and you trust and you just let it ride, which has been a good play. But, you know, part of it is you actually understand how businesses work and you understand how hard it is to make those changes. And so there are two or three things I always think that we're in the M&A business, right? We've bought a lot of businesses and we'll continue to do that. And so I look at myself as being an allocator, just maybe a little bit similar to how you invest. And so I start on sort of three levels. I think number one is, and I'm going to go, the last one's the most important, but I'll start from reverse, is I think many investors are, maybe this is the biggest flaw of investors, is they really don't understand the TAM of the product that they're investing in. There are so many investments I see where people assume growth rates continue forever without doing the real work and understanding that end market. And so I, you know, if I was a professional investor, I'd be obsessing on that end market. And so let's use like a quick anecdote here. You know, restaurants are, there's 750 or 800,000 restaurants in the United States. Half of them are really applicable to PAR. And you say, well, your product's $2,000. And I'm like, okay, so, you know, take $2,000 times by 4,000 restaurants, 400,000 restaurants, you get a TAM. And I used to tell people, and you probably remember this, was that's the TAM today. But every time we buy and build a new product, you're expanding that TAM. And we've proven that out now, right? We've got, you know, a loyalty product, we've got a back office product, still selling to those same customers. But it works the other way too, which is, I could have told you, hey, I'm selling a widget to restaurants and there's 4,000 restaurants and then I'm going to be the point of sale guy, and then I'm going to be the loyalty guy, and you would have been wrong. And so really understanding the end market and those dynamics are so, so, so important because they drive your churn. And listen, you get the best product in the world, but if you're selling to like businesses that have high churn, you'll never have a great business. And so I really understand that end market. I think I think so much about that now because I see that when I'm making deals in these businesses and I'm like, listen, you've got 100% growth rate, but like that's going to end. And that's the multiple I'm going to pay for you. The second one is product. I find that, you know, all of us have been influenced by the great value investors of our time. And, you know, they always tell you that you should be in your circle of competence. You should know the products. I would, you know, challenge everyone to be like, have you seen a demo of the company's product that you're investing in? Have you even seen a demo? And then have you gone into a store in our example and seen it work? Have you, you know, like that true like legwork of like understanding the product is so valuable. I've literally met CEOs of our competitors who've bought products and I'm like, I always ask a very specific question to see if they actually know anything. I'm like, how long is the demo? You know, like how long is their demo and their sales demo? And they'll be like, you know, I don't know. And I'll be like, all right, like you bought a company without watching the demo and you just trusted a bunch of other people to make that decision for you. That's instructive to me because everything crystallizes when you see that product. But the most important thing I've learned is the people side. I think, listen, you know, obviously, you know, when we came at the PAR, the stock's relatively low from where it is today. And, you know, I think honestly, all you had to do was just follow the people that were coming to PAR. You know, look at Raju's background and you're like, well, like that guy's got a lot of options. That guy can make a lot of money anywhere he goes. And he chose this rinky dink company, right? You look at some of these people that are leaving 3G and Google and coming to PAR and you're like, why are they joining a $250 million market cap company, whatever it is, right? You know, just look today. Today we announced that, you know, the CIO of the Atlanta Hawks just joined PAR to run our smallest business unit. Well, like that's kind of instructive. And before that, he was the CIO of Church's Chicken. And, you know, that's kind of instructive because you're like, that guy, you know, was the CIO of a 1,000-store restaurant chain or a 1,500-store restaurant chain. And he's coming to run PAR's smallest division. Why? You know, he's here to build something big and we've given him a great platform to be something great. And we think he's awesome and he's going to be amazing. But, you know, when you are able to attract that type of talent, like you can do all the work you want, but the people that live in the business know it better. And so I think just following where the people are going is a great thing I've learned. And, you know, Scott, I would tell you when we're buying businesses at PAR, I myself am going through every person on LinkedIn, seeing where they work, seeing how their references are, calling them up. And, you know, it's so easy to see sometimes you're like, gosh, like that team is just loaded with talent versus others where you can say, you know what, that's a team that built that entire product offshore. And they're just a services company pretending they're a software company. And so the people side, I think, is so, so valuable. There's a bunch of other stuff I can share with you later, but
give me a couple more.
you know, again, I'm talking purely from a software perspective, but you know, one of the things that I think is just a nugget to do is if you're buying, investing in a software company, go look at the bios of every salesperson. And if those salespeople came from Accenture and Deloitte and KPMG, you know, it's not the company for you. And what I mean by that is in services, you get paid to say yes. In product, you get paid to say no. You know, your sales guys are saying no and they still have to sell the product. That's very hard to do. But that means your identity is a product company and your margins will get to 70, 80, 90% like a great software business. Versus those that have hired people that come from, you know, great service companies, they dilute the product so fast because they start saying yes, 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 yes. And the product becomes bastardized because you're sort of doing customizations left and right. And so I really look at that. And then another nugget I'd tell you is, don't run away from low NPS companies. I mean, Scott, I'd ask you, how many products do you just absolutely hate? And then they've had great stock market return. Like, look at your cable companies, like, pretty obvious, right? And software is no different. You know, look at ADP. How many people love the ADP product? I mean, we're on ADP at Park. It fucking sucks to use. Like, I hate it. But I'm not getting off of it because it's got 50 years of Park's payroll records. And like, we need that data and, you know, all the DI work that we pull out of it and so on and so forth. And my point is that you can learn so much. And so, you know, so I look very deeply at that. And then, you know, part and parcel of that point on NPS is, you know, always ask for telemetry of the product. You know, how much time people spend on a product is absolutely tied to the quality of the moat of that business. And so you can find so many widgets within restaurant technology that have massive growth, perfect retention, perfect customer base. And then I'll be like, give me your telemetry. And they'll be like, well, I'm like, so like, you've all this stuff, but people spend like 12 minutes in your product a day. Like that all that means to me is like, you're just feeling a small acute need for that business, but you are not, you know, if I swap you out for somebody else, like you're not that important. And so I wrote this in our shareholder letter a couple of years ago, which is like software is not software. Everyone just sort of thinks like, oh, I look at growth, I look at retention, I look at churn, I look at like the quality of the end market, and like I make my investment. And it's a horrible way to invest. It's just truly horrible because not all the products are the same. And it, you know, when you come back 5 years later and you're like, holy crap, how did you have this like step function of like growth fall off? It's because you didn't do that work early on and you didn't realize, well, like, hey, I'm spending six, you spent that product that like had that great growth, all of a sudden lost its channel partnerships. SAP said, what? Sorry, like we're not promoting you anymore and your lead signed up. And so, you know, we go into all these, we've got a playbook, we go through all one of these things and we say, okay, like, does it hit all the boxes? And I think as an investor, because we've operated a business, we sort of know the questions to ask, we know how to get deep in the weeds on these things. You know, we know when I'm meeting the engineering teams, like how fast you publish in software? Oh, you're publishing like this? How often is it going from being into customer hands? You're like, wait, you told me you publish software every 10 weeks, but you're like releases to customers every 6 months. And so what does that mean? Well, that means, gosh, you're never going to be able to recruit great talent because great talent wants to see the thing they build into customers' hands as soon as possible. And so, you know, you can just learn a lot as you get in the weeds.
And do you have any investors that are asking you like questions around how often you're publishing software?
There are a few, like, I think there are a few that get in the weeds and understand it really well. And those are the best conversations we have because they understand, you know, if you would ask me that question, right, when I started, you asked me that question, you did ask, you know, or roughly sort of, I think I probably told you, but you know, when we started Par, we were publishing software to customers once or twice a year, right? Like, you know, and so you could have known like, hey, there's some problems over there.
And so this is an audience primarily of investors. And of the, you know, I guess do you see some mistakes that investors make when they're interacting with Par? Like, feel like kind of, they go out down the wrong path for certain reasons, or they're like, just maybe kind of help people.
I'm not one to judge like how people get to their answers. You know, I've seen people buy Par because they love like, hey, it's toasted great, you'll do great. You know, I've seen people buy Par because they know me for a long time and you know how obsessed I am with winning and sort of like, you know, been around me for a long time. And I've seen people bet against Par because they're like, you know, how are you going to beat Oracle and NCR? And you know, they have, you know, like 25% of the restaurant market, like they have more power. You know, I don't know if I have the right answer on the right or wrong way to look at it, but I would say that every single investor who spent more than a few hours, I think understands what we're building, why the opportunity is so large. And then it's just a bet is just the team to execute on. You know, I think people get caught in the weeds of looking at very small indicators and miss the big picture of you're not buying Par, Square, Toast, or anyone in restaurant software because you're looking at the next last quarter, next this quarter's numbers. And those are important. Like, trust me, we don't pay bonuses if you don't hit your numbers, but you're buying it because you're fundamentally believing that the restaurant is being eaten by software. And these are the platforms that you want that will be able to benefit the most on that. And if you don't get like that macro, it's just not worth it, because there will be clearly bumps in the road as you go. I mean, you know, like last quarter, if for example, PAR, you know, we couldn't book customers because I couldn't get products shipped from Korea to the United States. Like, you know, those things happen. But I promise you that if I wasn't the CEO of PAR, this thing is still going to grow very comfortably just because the end market is there. And so I think that, you know, listen, I am not someone that sort of like just close your eyes and hope for the best. We're super in the weeds. You know, my bonus is tied to margin and revenue. It's not tied just to growth. Like, you know, everything is set up the right way, but you kind of have to buy that end, that end state, or I think it's hard to get there. And let me just sort of give a specific example. When I became the CEO of PAR, our ARR was $10.7 million. 3 years later, it was 80 something million dollars. I couldn't have predicted that when I started. Maybe that's your Fight Club analogy, right? You couldn't have predicted that, right? That was sort of like a crazy transition. So like, you know, if I had gone in and said, well, your Brinks margins, gross margins are the 50s. So you're a services company, you're not a product company. And again, you can work through that. You would have missed that, right? But the right work would have been like, hey, like it's 10.7 million ARR. There's all these challenges, but the business is still growing. Like that doesn't, like why, right? Then you're like, wait, they got this guy 70. And then like, he just recruited all these guys from like, you know, great backgrounds to come here. And then you said, hey, I called 5 customers and they're all like, PAR sucks, but they're getting a little bit better. And then you're like, you know, you could have figured it out, right? And then you could have seen, hey, we were pretty smart capital allocators. We didn't, you know, we did a convert, we didn't do an equity raise because we hate the equity price. We, you know, made good decisions on who we bought. You know, we bought a business. I mean, this is sort of, I think, an amazing story, and we'll go down as one of the great things we've done. But, you know, we acquired an amazing business in Punchh, but Punchh was larger than PAR from an ARR basis, had faster growth, higher retention, you know, great talent for a third of our market cap, right? Like that was, you know, we were good allocators there. And so the point I was making that was not like we're patting ourselves on the back from going from 10 to whatever it is today. It's that that's very hard to sort of get in an Excel model. And so I think that those folks that have trouble with that have trouble, a little bit trouble with PAR.
Got it. And I do want to turn over to audience questions. I had one more thing that I just sort of a little bit of like where the puck might be going. Usage-based pricing. Can you talk a little bit about kind of what the opportunity might be there? Again, this sort of doesn't show up in historical numbers.
Yes. So I'm a big believer in, you know, hopefully our shareholder letter gets approved by compliance and you'll see a whole write-up in here. But usage-based pricing is sort of like this theme that, you know, you're starting just at the beginning to start to hear about. But to me, it's really outcome-based pricing. And so to me, this is just like the leg into like outcome-based pricing. But, you know, we live in a world where software is automating everything that we do, like literally everything that we do. You know, I use this word that software's eating the restaurant, because you're finding this, that every problem with a restaurant is, and using this example to get to the point, we used to be solved by a human being. There's too many people like in the drive-thru, send somebody out on a like, you know, tablet to take your order. And as all of those workflows move to software, you, that software company, are charging this one, these fees, and it's not aligned. Like if the product sucks, like you're still paying that. And so the way that I think conversely, there are certain software products like PARs that I truly believe are incredibly underpriced. You're paying us $170 a month, but for the $170 a month, we literally are sending data to every system you have. And if we go down, your entire store goes down. Your entire store can't operate. And so I've always been to like these restaurant CEOs and say, listen, I love you guys, but like for $170 a month, if I go down, your entire operations go down. But you'll pay $200 a month for like the Wi-Fi connecting app. And I'm like, how does that make any sense? Because if they go down, like you're still running, like, you know? And so I've said, you know, I'd rather like give our product for free and charge you for every transaction we process, or over time say, hey, where's your old transactions for your old company? Put this new product in. And like, if we create more revenue for you, we take a piece of that. And so I think in the end, software will move from, you know, license maintenance to SaaS, to some sort of transactional-based pricing, which is payments is a great example, Twilio is a great example, right? You use it, you pay for it. To then eventually like outcome-based pricing, which is we as a software company created a better outcome for your business, and we want to take a small piece of that because we delivered on it. Conversely, if we didn't deliver on it, we don't make anything. And so I envision like that's what's going to happen next. And so to give you like a super simple example, if you're a restaurant company today and your phones can't pick up a phone call, you got too many people calling. FYI, by the way, phone is still a huge channel for restaurants. It's an under-innovative way. And you don't have someone pick up that phone, you should just ship that to an AI bot, you know, and if Siri can process that order, that's free. That's literally free margin that just came your way. Like I should I shouldn't pay them 20 bucks a month. I should pay, here's 5% of that order, right? And so think of your minds a little bit of like, it's going to move from this sort of transition is going to move that way. And that's where we're building PAR, which is if we can deliver better outcomes, we should get paid more. And if we can't, we shouldn't. And so it's super intense. And I kind of love that.
Got it. Before we can turn over to audience, one more question. Just, I think you talked about sort of the seeing the migration of people. And I think one, if you didn't have to be that close an observer of PAR, with Ron and what they did. Can you just tell that little story? Because I think it's just sort of a simple one for folks to be like, oh yeah, like, I mean, there's like a press release, like you're not tracking deep, you don't have to go deep into the LinkedIn bios on that, but it's pretty powerful.
So one of our customers is a firm called Cava Grill. They're one of our fastest growing chains and really, you know, amazing organization. They were a customer of PAR and they were an angry customer of PAR, truly, truly, you know, unhappy. And, you know, when I got to PAR, they said, listen, we're bringing in Toast, we're bringing in couple other companies because we're going to rip you guys out. Like we love the thesis, but you guys have not delivered for us. And, you know, we said, hey, like give us 6 months. I'm not going to tell you we have the answer now, but let us get better and then make your decision. Don't make your decision on the past, make it on what we can deliver you now. And, you know, it was a really challenged relationship. It was the call that you would get and you were just like, God, like I just have to say sorry 100 times and apologize. And, but we got it right and we fixed it. And so when we just, you know, sort of made this decision to acquire Punchh and make that a core part of the PAR platform, we needed third-party financing. And lo and behold, you know, we went to our customer Cava and Ron Shaikh, who was the founder of Panera, the founder of Abu Pont, an incredible operator, compounded at 20 plus percent for 20 years. And you know, his group really chased us down and they said, listen, we didn't think you could fix this thing. Like, you know, our restaurants were really struggling. You were taking our restaurants down, like it wasn't working. And so we want to get behind that horse. We want to get behind that jockey. We want to get behind that team. And we believe that you can build this platform for the restaurant that no one has ever delivered on. And it was always our dream at Panera to create that end-to-end platform. We think you're the guys to do that. And we'd love to finance that transaction. And so it was this amazing experience, again, of a customer that hated us, like, you know, truly despised us. Like, you know, it's the kind of thing where if I saw them across the street in New York, I'd like cross the way so I wouldn't have to see them. I mean, it was that sort of, you know, unfortunate. Turning to them, not only saying, hey, we love you, we're going to continue to sign up and renew with PAR, so we actually want to invest in your company because we believe that you've delivered on your promises and we can help you build something great together. And, you know, I would just say that having Ron Shaikh on our board has been an incredible experience because he's not like an investor who's patting you on the back or yelling at you for numbers. He's like so in the weeds of, you know, what's wrong with the culture? What's with the operations? Like, you know, he's so intense and I truly loved it because he's been in our shoes and listen, he's delivered for a long time. So I think he looks at this as a partisan deliver that's on him.
Got it. And I think just from an investor perspective, right? Like, I mean, there have been press releases. Ron has been on podcasts and other places talking about the journey and stuff. And I mean, there are some dots that are harder to connect and there's some that are easier. And I think this is meaningful, but also easier. John, I think you said you'd moderate audience questions or a couple of them as time allowed.
Yeah, absolutely. We're a little bit short of time. We only have a few minutes, but I see more than 200 people participating here live and getting a bunch of questions. And I'm sure, Scott, you would be happy to have folks get in touch with you, prospective shareholders or existing shareholders that want to know more.
it's not a Greenhaven Road. I'll do my best. We have a lot of write about in our quarterly letters, and so there's a fair amount.
My email in the thing, or I'll put our IRS email maybe in the chat.
There you go. And if Scott or Savneet don't respond, you can always reach out to me. You can flood me with requests. That's fine. But maybe just one question in the next few minutes that we do have from, here's a question from Adam Wyden, who I know is an investor and advocate of the company. He says, PAR trades at a material discount to Toast and Lightspeed, yet their business trends are getting worse and yours are getting better. How do you think about this and your ability to execute future M&A?
You know, it's super important. So Scott, you didn't ask this question or you asked this question. I think I missed this, but one of the things I've learned is that you actually have to care about the stock price as a CEO. I think I was a little bit ignorant to this. And when I first got to PAR, people say, why don't you do a lot of IR? You know, I got rid of all PR and marketing at PAR. You know, the only thing I've done is 4 to 5 podcasts because I enjoy sort of like the long conversation. And I don't like being promotional. I'm a millennial and I don't really use social media. And the only thing I think, you know, I fight with shareholders is why don't we promote? And And I think I was wrong about this because our currency is our stock. And since we've been acquisitive, we need that stock to work. Otherwise, it limits the pool of stuff we can buy in. And so I think to Adam's point, you know, I'd like to think that PAR is oriented to deliver shareholder return. I think as an organization, we look at ROI, we think about it a lot. We really do believe we work for you. And I say in every meeting, which is, you know, the best person on PAR is the person that can drive the most long-term shareholder value to PAR. And so I think we're really trying our best to deliver that value. And we understand that the stock price is important. And so, you know, it's our job to sort of espouse the value, not be promotional, and hopefully our execution leads to that stock price. But I'd say it's been a learning for me in that, you know, you can't just pretend it doesn't exist.
Okay, great. Well, I think we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. But I have to admit, I didn't know much about PAR technology before this call. And now I do understand why super smart investors like Scott are comfortable being co-owners here. So Scott, Savneet, thank you so much for your time and for the conversation today. I feel privileged to have been a part of it.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Savneet.
Thanks all for participating. I hope you'll join us for our next live session with Brian Lawrence of Oak Cliff Capital in just a few minutes. Goodbye for now.